Cool.
Yeah, man. How things going?
They're going well. Did you get a chance to watch all the fights on Saturday?
Watch all of them, man. It was a sick card.
It was. So I only got to catch the Pena fight forward.
Yeah.
I had a ton of work I had to do. I actually have a book coming out in August. And
yeah.
So I was just kind of got lost writing that. But yeah, all of the fights were awesome. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, man. I mean, the night started off pretty good with the Tanner Boser knockout.
Nice.
Big old Canadian guy came in, beat the shit out of Felipe Lins.
Hell yeah, that's awesome.
But the whole main card was barn burner.
Oh, absolutely. And I thought, too, that a lot of those fights, from what I saw, like, were really a testament, though, at least with a couple in particular, I'm thinking of the need for both strength training and good strategy.
Yeah, for
because,
sure.
You know, because, like, and I'm thinking in particular with this, at least for the strength portion, and actually one of these for the fight IQ portion too, but like Pena and then Gall. Like, Luis Pena is a good fighter, but he just seems way too weak. You know, he just, it doesn't really seem to have any physicality to him.
Yeah.
And I think because of that, he's going to struggle to get finishes in positions where he should be getting them.
Kama Worthy's game too, though.
Oh, he definitely is. That's not to take anything away from Kama Worthy.
Yeah.
But there were a couple points where I thought it was just evident that Pena was just too weak. And I've seen that in a few of his fights at this point. It's not just coming from this one. But I just think he needs to get stronger in a big way. And I know strength and conditioning for MMA isn't awesome, because it's such a tricky sport to train for. Because everything will work a little, and it's also so new that the definitive way to train somebody for mixed martial arts from a strength training perspective, and this is coming from a strength coach, really hasn't been figured out yet. Like, that, there are some guys who are great with it locally, like Mike Perry over at Skill of Strength is doing a great job. He's the one who works with like Rob Font, Calvin Cater, Mike Rodriguez, Joe Lazon. But I see some guys just doing nonsense. And, and I have to wonder, too, like, what type of work, guys like Pena or Mickey Gall are doing.
Yeah, I mean, to Pena's defense, I guess for his weight class, he's massive. He's so tall. He's 6'3", right? So I think for his frame, cutting down that much weight, he's going to lose a lot of strength.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, maybe the move for him would be to try and go up.
Yeah, I think he's got a really good frame for 170. 6'3", he's lanky. If you just put a little bit of beef on him, maybe he'd be able to fight a little better at 170.
Yeah, who knows? Because I know he's been doing, fairly well in the UFC so far, but I think maybe that would be the move, because if guys are just going to be like too physical for you, then that means you need to get stronger.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you were talking about the Gall fight. I don't necessarily think that Gall looked weak per se. I think maybe like he gassed a little bit, but Mike Perry's obviously in better shape than Mickey Gall. Like, strength wise, that guy's a powerhouse.
Oh, yeah. I think Gall's bigger issue is just he went in with, frankly, just like a bonehead strategy.
Yeah.
And then didn't try to start grappling until he was already kind of tired and beat up. And, his striking looks pretty good. And I'm sure it is good. But he just doesn't look like he can crack an egg. And he was trying to throw hands with Mike Perry, who is like just a 5'10" fast twitch muscle. He looked so explosive and, had so much on everything he did. And then by the time he did start grappling, Perry was just able to kind of muscle him around.
Yeah. I was very impressed with the grappling. Super impressed with the grappling.
Oh, absolutely. Perry, I know Gall is the better grappler from like just a pure like nuts and bolts technique perspective.
Yeah.
But Perry, you could tell, didn't look lost. And at that point, at least, he was just so much stronger, because you know, Gall does have that gas issue, and Perry just, you know, clearly didn't, at least on that fight.
Yeah, and one of my old coaches, Loco Lobo, puts a really good point to it when he says, you could be a black belt, but every time I punch you in the face, you're going down another belt, you know? And I think Perry did a good job of just being the bigger guy, like being patient on the ground, you know, like he was really going position before striking. Like you could see that his fight IQ is getting better. And what I didn't realize that I heard during the broadcast is he's done a lot of training with guys like Rodolfo Vieira, who in my opinion was one of the most underrated grapplers in the world. You know, everyone talks about, you know, Gordon Ryan and Leandro Lowe and Buchecha, but Rodolfo Vieira, man, like before grappling really went mainstream, like he was the guy, right? This guy was an animal.
Oh, absolutely.
And when you're training with a guy like Rodolfo, who's now in the UFC, and they're training a lot together, you can kind of see how you can see how it's all coming together for Mike Perry, especially with the groundwork.
Oh yeah, and I think too, training with guys like that is nothing was going to surprise him. You know what I mean? Even if he doesn't actually have the skill that can be applied, you know, like somebody like Gall.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't mean he won't recognize and kind of know, you know, his anti-jiu-jitsu is clearly, you know, really good.
Yeah.
I mean, I know he got submitted by Cowboy when they fought, but I mean, but Cowboy is very underrated grappling, and he's also just a much bigger and stronger guy than Gall is.
Yeah.
You know, because like Gall had a couple, like it seemed like he was working for a couple of different things, but he just at that point, you know, just from being so fatigued, he had nothing on it.
Yeah, and I think you have to really like give props to Mike Perry's strategy where he kind of waited to the later rounds to get the grappling going. I mean, I know in the first round he landed that big takedown, but he kept most of the fight on the feet until the very end where I think he realized that Gall was tired and he knew he could just out-muscle him on the ground anyways. So hats off to Perry,
Oh, absolutely. And what did you think of his decision to have his girlfriend as a sole corner?
Yeah, I mean, in the beginning, it sounds kind of like a ridiculous thing to do. But then once you start listening to why, you know, like he really just needs, you know, guys in his corner that are there to support him on a friendship basis, which I understand, you know, and that's what I think you see a lot of in like New England MMA. And that's why these guys are such like tight knit groups is because they're not just teammates. These guys are realistically brothers, right? Where when a guy like Perry gets this kind of notoriety and he's moving around from camp to camp, like Greg Jackson doesn't give a shit about you. Mike Winklejohn doesn't give a shit about you. It's all about, you know, the volume, like the people they can attract into their gym. I know before when it was just, you know, like GSP, Rashad, and the UFC was on the rise, maybe they had better relationships with their fighters. But you saw with like a lot of guys actually leaving the Jackson Winklejohn camp because they just can't deal with the bullshit politics. So, I mean, Perry going there, and I think a majority of his losses came from that camp. You can kind of see the need to find, you know, friends to be around you, build a good team around you. So the fact that he's got his number one supporter in his corner, I mean – like you said, he's the one that's doing the training. He's the one that's got to fight at the end of the day. So, I mean, now it doesn't seem like as stupid as an idea as you think.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I definitely know what you mean. I mean, especially, too, like, when you think about Jackson Winklejohn, like, they're notorious, you know, like, Cowboy kind of, like, blew the whistle on that. But you can even see it with their behavior in the past. Because, like, the only two fighters they ever, like, grew that they built from the ground up were Diego Sanchez and Keith Jardine.
Yeah.
And, you know, if they let Diego walk because they wanted George St. Pierre to train there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, they, you know, they didn't give a fuck when it came down to, you know, money or notoriety or whatever. And so, I mean, you know, so they – and I get what Perry was saying. You know, he's clearly a very emotional guy.
Yeah.
So he wants to know that the people in his corner kind of have his back. I guess the thing that I take umbrage with – is that if you can let somebody who knows nothing in be your corner, you know, the state's going to license them, then why the hell do we need to get licensed?
Yeah, you know it's a super good point. Yeah, I mean,
like that's such a clear, like, kind of money grab.
Yeah.
That it's like, if they'll just let any schmo do it, then it's like, then yeah, why are we going through the saga dance of it?
Yeah, good point. And like, ultimately, I guess it kind of reverts back to last week's talk when we were talking about Max Roscoff, the guy that quit on the corner. I mean, the corner's job is to not just coach you, but like to have the best intentions for your fighter, right? Keep an eye on you, make sure you don't put yourself in any unnecessary danger. So point being, when you, like you just said, when you let a person that literally has zero fight experience, who openly admitted on the broadcast that she used to wrestle in high school, you know, and that's about the extent of her training, does some probably some Tai Bo boxing classes at a gym, you know, it makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and it's one of those things too, where, cause Perry can have both. Cause like the reality is, like, I know for instance, at my gym, social sport fighting, like we'll usually have my coach Bill Mahoney take the lead.
Yeah.
You know, I may speak up a bit more, like if they're doing a lot of striking, cause that's generally what I specialize in.
Yeah.
But for the most part, like, Bill will be the one talking, and then me and whoever else is cornering will be the ones echoing that to make sure the point gets across. And so you really only need, like, kind of one, like, kind of general in the corner. And, like, so he can still have his girlfriend and then somebody else, you know. But, like, you know, it does seem to be, like, kind of irresponsible, though, to just have your girlfriend. I mean, now, you know, it seems reasonable because he won.
Sure.
But, like, you know, but she wouldn't be able to tell when he's in real trouble and or what, you know, what if he needed to, you know, I mean, if he was facing somebody who's going to push him more than Mickey Gall did, you know, there may be points where he needs that advice and she wouldn't be able to give it.
Sure.
And so, I mean, so yeah, it's easy to say that now, but I mean, you know, if he had to fight Robbie Lawler or something next, is he really going to want to do that?
Yeah, I mean, he openly admitted on the broadcast that he is looking for a team. Like, his main goal getting paid is to go to South Florida. I think he's hinting at, like, an ATT move or training guys like Masvidal and Romero and getting a good corner behind him. And he did say that, okay, you know, my girl could be looking real pretty in the front row instead of the corner, you know. So, I think he's not he's not as dumb as we imagine. Like, he knows that he needs a corner.
Yeah, like, yeah, I forgot that in the midst of that psychotic tirade that he went on, he did mention that he needs a real team. Yeah. And, but honestly, too, I mean, if he wants sort of like if he wants a more personal touch, then I don't know if like ATT would be the move.
No, it wouldn't be.
A place that has 50 world-class fighters. And so, like, if you're just in the UFC, they don't really care. Like, unless you're ranked and a contender, then you're not really going to get the focus.
Yeah.
And so, like, maybe, like, a more tight-knit gym, like, you know, like, I was like, training with, like, the Scrap Pack over in California or, you know, or one of those other smaller world-class gyms would be the better move for them.
Sure. And then if you also think about the most recent politics at 170 at ATT, is that really the place you want to be right now, you know, training as a 170-pounder?
Oh, 100% with, you know, yeah. I mean, and so, I mean, who knows? I know he's also from Florida. He really likes it there. And so, I get why he'd want to go back, and that does sort of limit his options at that point. But it is good that he's at least acknowledging that he needs a real team.
Yeah, I mean, the one takeaway that I got from that fight is fuck the IRS.
Yeah.
When Platinum gets paid, taxes be paid.
Yeah, God. I mean, you can tell he doesn't really understand how a 1099 works.
Yeah.
he really needs to get, like, somebody who's going to handle his money right away so he doesn't just blow through it. But granted, that's also how guys get screwed by their CPAs and whatnot. So who knows?
Yeah. I mean, I really liked the, like, flow of information from all the fighters afterwards, like, giving him advice on what he should do with his money.
Actually, so I was listening to the Weighing In podcast that Josh Thompson and Big John McCarthy do.
Yeah.
And Thompson had an interesting idea where he was like, if you're going to just have your girlfriend anyway, then maybe sell the other two spots to, like, sponsors who will pay you 10 grand to be there.
Yeah. That's not a bad idea, but I'm sure the UFC would veto that in a fucking heartbeat.
I mean, but what could they really do about it?
You know? I'm also excited for this. I'm excited for this Reebok deal to end, man. I think it ends at the end of the year. Let's see what else they can do for these people.
I mean, do you not think they'll re-up it?
No. Personally, yeah, I think that, okay, Reebok gave him a good launch. Like, it was good phase. They got to mainstream it a little bit. But at the end of the day, I think they need to be fighter first, and especially, like, diving in on the topic that we talk about probably every week now because everyone's bitching about it, is fighter pay, right? So, I mean, Brennan Schaub, do you remember Brennan Schaub in the beginning? He was so vocal about it all, saying that, like, he pretty much – one of the main reasons why he did stop fighting wasn't just the sit down with Joe Rogan, was because he was losing $80,000 a fight on sponsors, man.
Oh yeah. I mean, now granted, I mean, it's tough because this, like, you know, because the Reebok deal helped the guys at the bottom and the ones who have no entrepreneurial muscle to flex.
Yeah.
But it hurt the guys like Schaub. I know Cowboy's another one who made a ton on sponsorships. And, like, so there were fighters who made a ton of money just on sponsors, but then most of them made, you know, little to none.
Yeah.
And so, and that's who the Reebok deal helped. But I agree. I think, you know, it sounds like, you know, the deal probably didn't really pan out. I've heard guys, you know, in the UFC in support of it. I've heard guys really vocal against it. And I mean, I'd be lying if I said I knew a lot of the ins and outs of it.
Yeah.
But I just hope whatever comes, you know, even if they renegotiated terms or something, you know, because I also wonder how beneficial this deal has been to Reebok. You know, not even just the UFC, but, like, you know, did they really see a huge return on it? You know, I don't know anybody who bought any of those, like, goofy fighter kits or anything.
Power Ranger outfits.
Yeah, spent $80 on a t-shirt, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. But, I mean, if you think about it, a lot of the guys in boxing obviously do their own sponsorships, right? Like, these guys get a lot of sponsor money. And if the UFC is kind of segueing into this, like, Zuffa boxing type area, how much longer do they really want to stick around with this kind of, like, singular sponsor for fighters? Yeah. And I mean, Mike Perry, I love reading the numbers. Like, I like seeing how much guys make the fight. Cause one, I find it ridiculous that a guy will go in there for three hard ass rounds, break his face, and get paid $15,000. And then, but if you think about it, like, you're really stealing from the fighters, in my opinion, if you can't give them that avenue to go out and find their own sponsors. Think about how much money a guy like Mike Perry or Conor McGregor, these guys that are very vocal, they're showmen, how much money these guys could really rack in on sponsors, you know? How much more money McGregor could have made in his career just by having sponsorship deals.
Yeah, but I suppose too, I mean, just to play devil's advocate a little bit.
Yeah.
So I think the reason why, from a company perspective, from corporate perspective, I think the Reebok deal was smart. For the UFC
to mainstreaming.
As a means of keeping, trying to make it so that no singular fighter gets bigger than the organization.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? By making it more branded and more uniform. And also, I feel like some fighters just have, like, kind of a narrow perspective on what being a sponsor is. Because it's not just about a logo on your banner. Like, they could be, like, selling social media shout-outs, appearances, all sorts of things.
Sure.
You know, using their platform to still get sponsorships. The only issue is they just can't be on your shorts. But what else do you have? I mean, honestly, like, I'm more likely to, take in something that GSP says on his social media than what he has on his, you know, scrawled across his butt.
Yeah. You know? Absolutely. Have you seen these, like, dodgy Polish organizations where these guys get, like, black paint painted on their backs and shit like that? And they've got, like, ads and websites, like, painted on their chest before they go out and fight?
No, but that's hilarious.
Yeah. Got to make money somehow, man.
Yeah, I mean, I respect it.
Yeah. Did you end up getting to watch the Julian Arosa fight against Sean Woodson?
Yeah. Yes, I did. I thought that was another issue of poor fight IQ.
Yeah.
Because I thought, like, Woodson is, you know, so good at what he does. Like, he's a professional-level boxer. He's super rangy. And for whatever reason, Arosa was, like, just trying to throw hands with him.
Yeah.
When Woodson was clearly struggling more, like, in the clinch and in the grappling exchanges. And then you notice, like, the moment Arosa kind of said, fuck it, let's play my game, he won.
Yeah.
You know?
Also, I find it absolutely shocking that after two rounds up and putting that kind of, okay, maybe the shots weren't hurting Arosa that much, that, I mean, Woodson is a significantly taller fighter, that Arosa was able to literally sink in a Darce choke and drag him down to the ground standing up, man.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like, I wonder too, like, what you know, just what element fatigue played into it too.
I think a lot.
Because if we, yeah, I mean, I agree. I think a couple of the subs we saw that night were more about fatigue.
Yeah, we'll touch on that one later.
yeah, I think you know exactly what I'm talking about. And even though, honestly, too, I'd attribute that to the Pena loss too.
You know, because yeah, you
know, he didn't have control of his legs in that choke. You know,
for sure.
He, I'm not saying Pena would have gotten out, but he could have done something. And you know, when, you know, the W and the win bonus is on the line, it's like, you know, do something.
Yeah. Big shout out to Arosa, like, though. I mean, back against the wall.
Oh, yeah. Well, honestly, too. Yeah. And it's like, and that was just, yeah, it was a cool moment, a cool story, you know, taking the fight on short notice, you know, so literally coming off the couch and then beating an up and coming prospect like Woodson, who it sounds like everybody was scared to fight. I think that's great.
Yeah, absolutely, man. And Takashi Sato, big KO win. I mean, he fought this Jason Witt guy in like a couple days notice, so.
Oh, yeah. And I thought that, you know, that was just, you know, such a, you know, beautiful punch right down the pipe.
Yeah.
You know, just put him out.
Yeah, and I'm happy for Japanese MMA. I mean, there's not a lot of guys out there representing Japan so hard. I mean, I love Shane Aoki.
Yeah, I was going to say, at least on the UFC. I know one has more of them, but I mean, the UFC really doesn't have a whole lot of, you know, Japanese representation there anymore.
Yeah, I actually got to train at Evolve MMA for about 9 months while I was living in Singapore, and diving away from the UFC, I mean, those guys got a lot of really good talent. Like, got to do a little bit of training with, like, Shinya Aoki. Carl Uno came by a couple times. Like, a lot of cool guys.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, a lot of people don't respect the talent level in, like, Bellator and ONE FC.
Yeah.
You know, but, like, I mean, they're still largely UFC-level fighters.
Yeah, I mean, you saw Eddie Alvarez get knocked out in his first fight in ONE FC, man, so.
Oh, exactly. And, I mean, and hell, look at, you know, when Strikeforce and the WEC merged with the UFC. I mean, you know, God, a lot of those guys ended up going on to become, you know, top contenders and title holders.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I think when you look at a lot of the fighters there, like Bibiana Fernandez, like super tough guy. I think he could contend like in the UFC as well, probably fight for a title. And Demetrius Johnson hasn't had an easy fight in ONE FC, dude. And he's fighting a lot of guys that people have no clue who they are. You know, they're just talented Asian MMA fighters, you know, and these guys are coming in and okay, he's not like Demetrius isn't dominating guys like he was in the UFC. Like these guys are really putting up a fight against him.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, you know, so, like, UFC has done a tremendous job of branding themselves as the premier organization. They certainly are. But that doesn't mean that they have a monopoly on the talent.
For sure. I mean, the guy that manages Evolve MMA, I'm forgetting his name right now, but he's from where is he from? He's from somewhere in Mass, dude. I met this guy when I was signing up to the gym, and the guy that runs the whole place is from Mass. I mean, it's a sick gym to be around. These guys have, like, 5-6 facilities all over Singapore, and it's not a really big place, and each place you go to, it's just super high talent. You got a lot of surprise guests coming through. Like, I met Sanchai on the side of the street one day, just like walking around with his posse. Like, you get to see a lot of really cool people there, man. And it's a beautiful facility. Everywhere you go, that gym is high class, dude. Anyone that fights there.
Oh yeah, that's awesome. That sounds like it was a great experience for you.
Super good experience, man. It was weird being at Evolve because obviously Ariel Sexton is like a very close teammate of ours. He was even teaching at Junigo for a while, and he's taken out a couple of the guys at Evolve MMA, you know. So, but he's very friendly with them, and got to talk to a lot of these people. And the coach there, Teco, he was actually Bushesha's jiu-jitsu coach up until he was like a blue belt, almost purple belt level. So a lot of high level people teaching, yeah. A lot of high-level people there. It was a great
gym. Is Ariel still affiliated with you guys at all?
Yeah, I think he's like Daniel Gracie affiliated for sure. But as far as teaching at Junico, I think he's not there any longer. It's Bruno Jacare that's teaching the classes over there. Yeah, but I think he's still affiliated with us, like not Junico team in particular, but you know how these things work. You know, Junico is our brand. Like
the he's still associated with,
Yeah, that's so he's in. Like, I talk to him whenever we get the chance and stuff like that. But, yeah, for sure, great experience in Singapore. A lot of high-level people out there. Shout out to Evolve MMA. Really good experience. Did you get a chance to watch the Brennan Allen fight, man, against Kyle Daukaus?
I did. That was an awesome fight.
Yeah, but that was a sick – I think a lot of the grappling matches in MMA, like, don't get as much shine as much as, like, the striking wars. But as far as, like, a grappling match is concerned, like, two high-level grapplers, it was a really good fight.
Oh, definitely. I definitely didn't agree, too, with the 30-27 call.
Yeah, definitely not.
You know, I thought that was dumb. But yeah, I mean, that was a great fight. You're right. And grappling really doesn't get the credit it deserves. And I think a lot of that just comes down to, well, I think people are becoming more educated as fans.
Yeah.
If you don't know what you're watching, it can be tough to, like, really follow what's happening. I mean, like, honestly, like, full disclosure, before I started training at 19, I, like, thought MMA was fine.
Yeah.
You know, but I didn't really get it because I didn't know what was happening. And so, like, it wasn't until I started doing it that I was able to appreciate it and grew to love it like I do.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, but I remember watching, like, the old, like, Tito Ortiz fights, and I was like, yeah, I mean, this is, like, cool and all, but, like, I don't really get it.
Yeah. Yeah, I completely get that, man. I think it was, like, super back and forth, good fight. I think for those people that understand what's going on the ground, me being a jiu-jitsu whore over here, like, I was sweating in my seat watching that fight, man. I was loving it.
Oh, yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah, I mean, Brennan Allen actually broke his face and his nose in that fight from those elbows Daukaus was hitting him with. So it goes to show that just because the apex is empty doesn't mean those shots don't fucking hurt, man.
Yeah, I mean, and like I said, too, I feel like, you know, and I know we've talked about this before, but I think having the empty venue ends up, like, adding a little more, like, oomph to the fights because, like, you can hear the shots as they land. You know, and it just, you know, it really helps to convey just how hard these guys are hitting.
Yeah.
You know, it just, you know, to me at least, really adds to the experience.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I mentioned in the first podcast episode, like the Tony Ferguson, Justin Gaethje fight, I know it wasn't at the Apex, but that's the fight that really, like, turned me on to this empty stadium, dude. Like, every fucking punch that guy threw, like, I was in pain, dude. That's absolutely wild.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, on to the Morris Green versus John Volante fight, dude. I thought John Volante looked like a bum in that fight, dude. He looked fat, like he's been eating lasagna for the past 4 months.
Yeah, I mean, in the cage. He looked like a dad fighting at fucking Chili's or something.
It was he looks like awful. That baseball dad yelling at his kid to run to first base, I mean, you know.
And then so, like, it, you know, it stinks because, like, to me, you know, like, because a lot of times the guys go up in weight, you know, like, we've seen they'll do well, you know, cause, like, they're doing it right. They're still trying to move forward, you know, in the sport. But it's, you know, when somebody comes in looking like that, you know, that just tells me maybe that he's not really invested anymore. You know, didn't want to cut the weight, but it's not like he just put on muscle. He came in looking... That was, like, he just looked soft.
He looked slow, too, like, way slower than he is at 205. Like, he wasn't moving, man. I didn't see the guy move at all.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And, like, you know, and yeah, that, you know, that arm triangle that he got caught in at the end. I mean,
wasn't an arm triangle.
I mean, I, you know, and, like, and honestly, like, you can hit that from under half guard. It's difficult, but you can.
It's got to be tight. I mean,
it didn't look like Mo Green really had the angle to.
Had to be on the opposite leg. If you think about it, he was half guard on the other leg and then throwing the legs over here, you know? And that's not where you get the pressure to the choke. You got to be on the opposite side.
And, like, and, you know, and so I'm happy Mo Green got the win. You know, I mean, and I thought he deserved it.
Yeah.
But, that was, like... I don't know. That was a tough fight to watch.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so I don't think that Maurice Greene is the most talented striker. I thought that a lot of what we saw, he did win those rounds, but it was more of like the, like that. I just think of like the, whenever I think of people kicking like that, the first fight that comes to mind is like the Carlos Condit, Nick Diaz fight. Where like, mm-hmm. even though Diaz was landing like cleaner punches to places that mattered, the judges really look for just volume in that fight. And those little, little kicks to the legs and little kicks to the body. I mean, okay, you're scoring points and stuff like that. So I could see how he won the first two rounds, but I was just super disappointed with Jean Valente. I mean, he caught him with those big punches. He has the better experience on the ground. I mean, he fights it out of Cerro Longo, for Christ's sake. Like, the guy's training with monsters on the ground, and he gets caught in something bullshit like that. I think that it's a little disappointing for Valente. I thought he could have won in the third round if he just kept the fight on the feet and just try to search for the head more often.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, ironically, like, the third round seemed to be where when he kind of came alive.
Yeah.
And but then I think he probably just blew his wad, tried to put him away.
Yeah.
And, you know, because he was landing good punches.
Huge punches.
Because I felt like in the first round, he didn't, you know, he was just moving really slow and awkwardly. And, you know, it just, it really didn't look great. But yeah, I mean, in the third, that was when, you know, like I said, he seemed to kind of come alive. Up until the point that he got caught in that choke.
Whatever the fuck that was.
You know, for lack of a better term, we'll call it a choke.
Yeah.
and so, I mean, you know, it's too bad. I mean, do you think the UFC keeps Valente after this?
I think that Valente's a guy that they'll probably sit him down and say, listen, like, heavyweight's not for you, man. Like, you don't look good there. Either cut the weight or walk.
Yeah, I mean, that was hard to watch, though.
Absolutely, because, I mean, we've seen a lot of fight, like, good fights out of Valente, and he actually looks good at 205. And
he does.
Like, physique-wise, he looks good. I think he moves well. He's quicker. Like, he's got really good hands. I just don't understand the logic behind the move to heavyweight. So, and like we said, he just looked like dad bod city, dude.
Absolutely.
He looks like me after a trip to Italy, dude.
Well, like, even a guy like Big Country, you could tell had a lot of muscle in addition to the belly. It didn't really look like Valente had that.
No.
You know what I mean?
But so, Big Country is also astoundingly quick for a fat guy.
To the point where him being fat was sort of a point of pride for him.
Yeah.
But Valente is kind of, you know, the opposite.
For sure. We already touched on the Mike Perry-Mickey Gall fight, but once again, hats off to Mike Perry. Came in with a good fight plan and absolutely pulled out the victory. The main event, obviously, like, fight of the year contender. These guys went in there, and it was like they were fighting in a fucking elevator, dude. These guys were beating the shit out of each other.
Oh, yeah. That was awesome. I was honestly really impressed with both of them.
Yeah.
And I mean, no, granted, I feel like as MMA fans, we tend to have like a relatively short-term memory, but because of that, I'm willing to say that was one of the best fights I've ever seen.
Yeah.
and I mean, it was great. I mean, I think like the only sort of like critique I had of anything in there was I was like practically screaming at the TV for Poirier to stop jumping on guillotines. You know, because like one or two of them seemed to be kind of deep, but for the most part, he just seemed to be like giving points away to the hooker.
Yeah.
And I know I was always taught by my coach Bill Mahoney, and I agree with this, that if you get a submission deep and you don't get it, you don't go for it again.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Cause, like, if you weren't gonna get it when the guy wasn't expecting it, then you're not going to get it when he is.
Yeah, and I think another point that we touched on also with the Woodson fight is that Hooker was a taller fighter, and I think that when you're getting taken down like that, it's very hard for you to lock in a guillotine jumping like that when you don't have, like, the right leverage because the guy's too up on you, you know? And you can see when Hooker was hitting those takedowns, like, he's actually coming up pretty high. So Poirier, like you said, was actually jumping for those guillotines, and it's never going to work.
Exactly. Yeah, it's so much harder to control the hips at that point.
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, when they're starting to stack, you kind of need to put, like, extend the hips away.
Yeah.
And when they're that much longer, then that becomes so difficult to do.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of guys that, I mean, like, once they get a hold of your neck tight, it doesn't really matter if they have one legs, two legs. Like, sometimes you might even have the urge to tap before, you know, you even get to the ground. You know, some guys can cinch that up so deep, but obviously in that situation, that was not the case at all. And he was just jumping for God knows why.
I mean, I think part of that was fatigue. Another part was he knew, you know, because in the first, you know, as I had the first two rounds for Hooker, last three for Poirier.
Yeah.
And so I think too, that was part of me, him knowing that he was down on the cards and probably just wanting to start going for broke, but trying to get the finish. You know, because, I mean, they were very, like, even standing. And if anything, I'd maybe even give a slight edge to Hooker in the first half of the fight.
Yeah.
You know, just because he was so long, was, you know, working the body so well. And, you know, and like I, you know, I've said in the past, like, I think Hooker is just a bit more dynamic. Like, I think, I think Poirier has the better hands, but I think Hooker has far more weapons that he uses, and he was using all of them.
Yeah, for sure.
So I think part of it was Poirier wanting to go for the finish because he knew, you know, he understood that it was super close and maybe even he was down. And also, too, I think he probably just thought he'd maybe have an edge grappling.
Yeah, I've seen Hooker on the ground in previous fights, and I think just he, especially when you start sweating like that in the second and third round, like a guy like Hooker that's really tall and long on the ground and isn't like a slouch, let's say, with his jiu-jitsu game, one of the toughest people to grapple with. And I think Poirier was a little in over his head, but I have to say that I really liked the – I loved, actually, the adjustment in the fifth round where instead of, you know instead of trying to control Hooker on the ground, he was just sprawling and brawling at that point, right? Like, you know, stuffing takedowns, moving away, and really hitting him with combinations. And it was a really good adjustment.
Well, yeah, I mean, honestly, like, that's arguably after, like, messing up the first guillotine attempt, or not, I shouldn't say messing it up because it's not like he did anything wrong, but after not getting that first attempt, you know, I mean, that's probably what he should have immediately transitioned to, like, using that head control to either get back to the feet, get on top, or anything like that. Because, you know, because I've even in the past, like, used guillotines to sweep, and, you know, and all that stuff, and rather than just necessarily trying to finish the choke, because the issue with that, too, is that if you don't get it, then you're probably – then you're losing points on the judges' scorecards.
For sure. I also think that when you're up that high on a guillotine, it's like you have so many options from the guillotine. Like, you can kind of snake your hand in, whizzer, like, try to use the fence. There's so many things you can do from that position. A lot of guys even try to, like, you know, use that momentum falling back down to the ground to, like, just get you over. And then once you guys are in, like, you know, a 50-50 position, scramble back to the feet. But you could tell he was really committing to those guillotines. And I if I recall, I think he was also doing the same in the Khabib fight, but it was pretty deep in the Khabib fight.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, that seems to be what he, you know, what he kind of does when he doesn't either want to keep fighting for to defend the takedown.
Yeah.
You know, or maybe whether it's like through fatigue, or maybe he just doesn't think he can. Because it's weird. Because, like, with Khabib, it's almost, you know, I almost think there is validity to not even trying so hard to stop the takedown, but being prepared once you hit the mat.
Sure.
Like, for something that you immediately start attacking with. I mean, granted, that's all speculation because I don't know what it takes to beat Khabib. But fighting the takedowns doesn't really seem to work.
Yeah, for sure. It's probably just one of those. I mean, I think a lot of fighters have these just, like, bad habits, right, man? Like, you find yourself in this position.
I mean, absolutely. Well, Poirier has a really good guillotine, I think. And so I can see why that would be sort of his go-to. And also, too, I mean, at that point, he was, you know, they were both banged up, you know, probably, you know, pretty concussed at that point. And your mind does weird things when you're in that.
Yeah, absolutely, man. But Hooker, dude, two back-to-back fight of the nights, dude. I think he's taken a lot of punishment over the course of 10 rounds. Let's see how he recovers. But there's some interesting matchups for him in the future, too. Like, I think he called out
calling people out after a loss, pretty crazy. But he was calling out Charles Oliveira and some other people. So I'd like to see him back in the mix soon.
I agree. And, you know, and I think, too, that, you know, he's obviously still super young. I think there's, you know, a lot he can do. And but, yeah, I hope he gives himself the time to recover. And, you know, because like you said, there was a lot of punishment.
10 rounds, man.
Those past couple fights, exactly. You know, so I hope he just takes the time that he needs to. And then, you know, lets his body heal. So then he, you know, whoever he does fight in the future, they can come back at 100%.
100%. Otherwise, was a awesome fight card top to bottom. A lot of entertaining shit. Did you see that they're bringing back the Ultimate Fighter?
I did. You know, I'd heard that for a little while, but you know, but God, I first heard rumblings of that probably like 6 months ago.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's interesting that they're finally pulling the trigger. I mean, because they definitely seem to have moved away from it. Because I mean, people largely
Contender Series and
yeah. I mean, you know, the Contender Series are kind of a little more compelling, anyways, and the. You know, well, let's lock these guys in the house and watch them get drunk and, you know, but, you know, I mean, you know, I used to be a huge fan for like probably, I think the last one I really watched seriously was the one where Bisping and Mayhem were coaches.
Yeah.
You know, just because that was the first time seeing the 135ers and 145ers on the show. So there was a deep talent pool.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, you know, TJ Dillashaw, John Dodson, you know, all came out of that. But, you know, I think once we realized that, A, winning the Ultimate Fighter isn't that big of a deal, and once the talent pool got diluted because they kept doing it,
yeah,
it just, you know, it kind of lost a lot of its impact.
100%, because, I mean, like you said, the main thing is talent pool, right? So, the Ultimate Fighter has brought upon a lot of champions to the UFC, and you've seen a lot of really talented guys make their way there. But as you started watching the later and later seasons, you got to really see how, like, these guys won the Ultimate Fighter, and then once they got to the UFC, they were like 0-3 cut.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, you have guys like Jonathan Brookins and Amir Sadala who both look good on their respective seasons, and then, get cut within, you know, within 5 to 10 fights, which, you know, really isn't a whole lot, you know, from, like, a fighter's career.
Yeah, I mean, you have a fighter in your gym. Joe Giannetti, right, was on the undefeated season?
Yeah. So that was, I think, season 28.
What does he say about his experience in the house? Like, has he ever told you what it's like?
Oh, yeah. No, he loved it. I mean, he's one of those guys who I feel like can thrive in that environment.
Yeah.
And honestly, in the house, that was the best I've ever seen him look, you know, because he, you know, I had actually worked with him a lot leading into it. And then I know he got really good work from Cormier and his team while he was in there.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think he lucked out by the sheer virtue that it was an undefeated season, you know, just because, like, you know, undefeated in MMA generally means you haven't fought anybody.
Yeah.
You know, and so that was like a good one for him to jump in on. And like, and they, you know, they had some good guys in there. You know, I mean, like Mike Trezano, who Joe ultimately lost to in the finale, is talented. And then, you know, Violent Bob Ross.
Yeah.
Luis Pena, you know, came out of it. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I've known a few people who went through it. They, you know, they all say like it's tough being there, but I mean, it is a good opportunity to get really good exposure. You know, because I know the UFC likes dealing with Ultimate Fighter veterans, A, because the fans do know them a bit more at that point.
Sure.
And also too, it gets them all comfortable being on mic. You know, because they want guys who are going to be able to, you know, look good in the press and, you know, give good interviews, cut good promos. And Ultimate Fighter vets are just, they're better at that than your average prospect generally.
Yeah, absolutely. I saw that couple of videos of JoJo talking about training with Khabib. Did you ever get a chance to go down to AKA and see these guys train?
No, I've never been out there myself. I know Joe loves it. He probably wants to go out there more frequently, but it's all very expensive. And I mean, you know, I mean, God, like right now, there'd be no point to it. I know at this point, JoJo just really wants to fight.
Yeah, I can understand. I think I've seen a couple of promotions trying to put fights together. So let's see how things go moving forward. But I was reading an article today on MMA Junkie that they're trying to get Paulo Costa and Israel Adesanya to coach that season.
Oh, really? That would be cool. I think Adesanya would be a really fun guy to have coach because he's somebody who is great on the mic. He cuts a good promo, so he'd probably be like a fun presence in the house.
For sure.
And I'm sure we'd see some fun back and forth between him and Paulo Costa.
It would just remind me of that Vanderlei Silva, Chael Sonnen Ultimate Fighter. You know, you got a guy that's really witty and can talk well, and another just like aggressive meathead Brazilian. No offense to my people out there.
I was gonna say, yeah, for lack of a better term, like a goon.
Yeah.
You know, because I remember a point where Chael was talking about, like, with Vanderlei, like, I'm supposed to be the bad guy here, and you're making it very difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, but I'd love to see that. I mean, the Ultimate Fighter always, like, I love to see the back and forth with the coaches more than I like to see the back and forth with the fighters, you know, because the back and forth with the fighters is bound to happen when you get that cabin fever living with a group of guys for, what is it, like 8 weeks or something like that, 6 weeks. But the coaches, like, you see it year and year again, like the Garbrandt Dillashaw season where he grabbed him by the neck, and you get to see a lot of crazy shit, and the Vanderlei trying to fight Chael Sonnen and Chael taking him down to the ground. And I'd be excited to see a guy like Costa and Adesanya. Costa, a guy who really hates Adesanya, coach a season of the Ultimate.
Exactly. And I think, too, that you probably hit the nail on the head with it being similar to the Chael Vanderlei season.
Yeah.
Because, like, similar to Chael, Adesanya largely seems to be playing.
Yeah.
When he's, you know, sort of, you know, talking about other fighters, but, you know, Costa, somebody who seems to take it way too seriously. So, you know, so I mean, that would definitely be a compelling, you know, sort of back and forth, or it has the potential to be. I know I definitely watch it if that's what ultimately comes together.
100%. I'd like to see them maybe try to do some different stuff as well, you know, because 28 seasons, 29 seasons, however many seasons they've had, like, you got to kind of switch it up at some point.
Yeah. And I mean, and the tweaks that they always make are kind of really small.
Yeah.
You know, because at the end of the day, there's only so much you can do with, these are all 20-somethings living in a house, watch them drink, watch them occasionally work out, and then they fight each other.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, otherwise, man, all good with you guys? How's the lockdown still going?
It's good. So things are finally starting to open up here in you know, and they're letting professional athletics work. So, like, fighters are at least able to start training.
Yeah.
And stuff again. But, yeah, it's been tough. And how are things in Germany?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much returning to normalcy. I mean, the closest big city is Hamburg, and only about 5,000 cases for 1.5 million people. So, things are looking good. The EU just opened up travel yesterday. I think today's the second, right? So, officially they're letting a lot of people travel without 14-day quarantines and stuff like that, which kind of sucks for me because I'm leaving in August and trying to come back, so I'll have to spend 2 weeks cooped up, can't buy groceries, gotta just suck it up.
I mean, can they really enforce that though?
Yeah, I mean, I know that in the States it seems impossible, but I had a friend of mine, she left work here, went back to Stamford, Connecticut. And when she came back, she had to register with, like, I mean, Germany is like another, honestly, bro, I've never lived in a place like this. They handle things absolutely so, what's the word? It's so organized, and I don't know how they do it, but it's so controlled. And they cooped her up for 2 weeks. She wasn't allowed to buy her own groceries. She had to specifically order her groceries through like a website to get them delivered. And, people came and rang her doorbell and saw if she was there. And it's a big fine if you get caught moping around while you're in quarantine.
Huh. Damn. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe we do. Hey, things like that, like, seem, like, fundamentally un-American.
Yeah, super fundamentally un-American.
It's like, I can't, like, my brain can't even process that.
Yeah.
But I would say, maybe we should institute something like that, because we there, you know, so Massachusetts is good. We've had the past couple days, we've had no new deaths.
Yeah.
From coronavirus, and but we are one of the only states that's doing well.
I heard it's four states, right? Four states on track. It's like Rhode Island, Mass, a couple other ones doing pretty good.
But a second wave has hit.
Yeah.
And it's been not awesome for places like California, Texas, and Florida.
Florida's funny, man, because they were talking a lot of shit in the beginning, saying they were saying, "Oh, look at us down here. There's no coronavirus. We're not going to do anything." And then that bitch came hard, man. That bitch came super strong, and now they're struggling down there. And I feel bad. I really do. And but ultimately, I know a lot of people, like you said, like quarantining is fundamentally un-American. You feel like you're being controlled, right? So I can understand how a lot of people feel kind of cooped up.
And I think that coupled with the general, so you know, with the issues we've been having with like police brutality, that coming to light.
Yeah,
it's all been combining to just there being kind of an anti-government sentiment.
Because, for sure.
You know, when you think about it, and I'm not saying there hasn't been good reason to do the quarantine and all that. That's, you know, I have no ground to stand on with that, but it can all, you know, signal government overreach, which, I mean, even in a place like Massachusetts, which is generally very progressive and more for big government and stuff, that is just fundamentally not super American.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I lived in Singapore, man, and a lot of these people were telling me there's so many rules, like there's this, this, and that, like, obviously rules that don't affect my life, you know, like the fact that there's no drugs in Singapore, that's fine for me, man. Like, not a big deal. Like the fact that there's no chewing gum in Singapore, like I don't fucking chew gum anyways, like whoop-de-doo. And a lot of people feel like they're a little controlled in Singapore, but I moved to Germany, dude. And holy shit, like this place is, this is a real land of rules, bro.
Well, they've been historically very for big government.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, man. Well, we won't touch on that. You know, I do have some people in Germany that listen to the podcast.
Yes, I. Okay, I mean, as a representative of the Semitic people, I felt like I needed.
Yeah, as a representative, that's completely fine, man. Shout out to the people. But otherwise, dude, like, there's a ton of rules out here, man. And I think that in situations like this, it really worked out for the better. I mean, it sucks having to work from home, and it sucks, you know. You can't socialize. You can't do this. You really got to buckle down and like be strong, you know. But in the end of it, you see now that besides a couple of hotspots here in Germany that have kind of exploded with the infection rates, like everything's pretty much back to normal. Like you can sit in a bar until 3 o'clock in the morning. You can go out to dinner with your friends. Like the restaurants have seating outside. They have seating inside. You can go into the grocery store. A lot of places will even let you swing by without walking inside with a mask, you know, like walk into a store, got to buy something real quick. Like sometimes we'll even come to the front door just to serve, you know, what do you need? Take the cash and leave. So it really does work. I mean, granted, America's a little more difficult. You've got obviously four times the population in America. It's when things go rampant, they're much harder to control. There's a lot less, let's say, besides the IRS, you know, influence on people's lives.
Yeah. I mean, it just the size, you know, this is so big, there's so many people, and we've, you know, because the United States could really be broken down into several separate countries with how different culturally certain areas are.
Sure.
And that does make it harder to, to control. Now, when you have a lot of people, like, you know, obviously Donald Trump is not super popular as president, so a lot of people kind of want to tell him to fuck himself anyway.
Yeah.
And so that was actually why I thought he, at least from a diplomatic standpoint, initially handled it well by saying, well, I'm going to let the governors figure out what they want to do.
Yeah.
You know, which is kind of like the playing safe. I'm just not going to make a decision about it.
That's sure.
It. But yeah, it's been tricky. And so I'm hoping things can go back to normal soon, you know, that they can either, you know, discover some vaccine or whatever, but you know, it's been tough, especially if we end up having to face another shutdown.
Would be hard. What are they? I saw that phase three is coming soon for Mass, at least, that they're letting gyms open. Does that also entail like the martial arts gyms?
So I've heard martial arts specifically, we're going to have to wait till August.
Ah.
And, but I mean, you know, it's, you know, so we'll see though. I mean, there's been a lot of pushback, you know, and you know, it's, I think because things are going so well, there's going to probably be even more.
Yeah.
Because people aren't going to, you know, people just, they have short-term memories. They're not going to, you know, I mean, hell, once the incident with George Floyd happened over here, it seems like most people, myself included, stopped paying any mind to, you know, to the fact there was also a pandemic happening.
Sure. And, can understand, you know, that.
Just like the gears completely switched. And so, you know, hopefully that things can, you know, get rolling pretty soon and we can start going back to normal. Because there have also been, well, yes, the quarantine, you know, quarantine's been shown to be effective. I mean, Massachusetts was one of the early leaders in it. And we largely, too, kind of, you know, played ball. And so, as a result, we're one of the better states for it.
Sure.
But there's been a lot of sort of like silent casualties to it. Like suicides have gone up. You know, domestic violence has gone up. People not going to get early screenings for cancer have gone up. You know, yeah. What I mean? You know, instances of depression are way up. So it's like, so you almost have to wonder, overall, is it better for the health that we quarantined?
Yeah, I mean,
obviously with the huge economic impact and all that. And I don't like to touch that. And I, you know, because it's like, because it's hard, you know, I mean, like, I get that. And this is coming from a small business owner myself. You know, I mean, obviously, I want to stay in business and be able to earn a living. But at the same time, if me losing a few bucks mean some people get to live who would otherwise die, I'm all for it.
Yeah.
You know, and so, like, so that, you know, so I try not to touch on, like, the economic issue.
Sure.
Even though, it, you know, because also, too, It always bounces back. You know, we've been due for a bear market anyway. And so, it, you know, I guarantee it'll bounce back.
100%. Has the state touched upon what they're doing for the beaches on the 4th of July? I know we've got a very important day in 2 days coming up.
Yeah. Not that I've heard of, but I also don't know if there'd be any stopping it.
Yeah, you know? I can imagine. Except just total closure.
Exactly. I mean, they didn't even do anything about Memorial Day. That was like in the midst of, like, that was before everybody just started saying, fuck this anyway.
Yeah.
Can understand. Well, thanks for joining me today, man. Happy 4th of July. Hope you have a safe weekend. Hope all's good on your
Sounds
end.
Good. Sounds good, man. You too. This was fun.
Yeah. Awesome, man. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today, guys. Have a happy 4th of July. You can follow us on Instagram at 10YBB and you can listen to this on any major podcast streaming app that you so choose. Cheers.